prohibitions. The executive branch is printing money without regard to any stockpile of gold or silver, then selling that paper money to a cartel of private banks for the cost of the ink and the paper, then borrowing back that paper money from that private cartel with principal equal to the face amount printed on the paper money at an interest rate determined by private cartel, then taxing the labor of citizens to pay the interest on that debt. And Congress has acquiesced. In spite of constitutional guarantees, the executive is collecting its tax on labor through a nationwide campaign of fear, intimidation, and coercion, and by the use of swarms of armed agents to search and seize the private property of working Americans, and the Congress has acquiesced. In spite of constitutional guarantees, the executive and the Congress have refused to hear the people's petitions for redress of these grievances. In spite of constitutional guarantees, the executive is harassing and penalizing those citizens whose petitions for redress have gone unanswered and who are now acting to stop the withholding, they're acting to stop withholding and payment of the illegal direct tax on labor, and tribunals inferior to the U.S. Supreme Court are cooperating in this abuse of governmental power. The Constitution is, in other words, hanging by a thread. The First Amendment right to petition, which includes the right of redress before taxes, is the only nonviolent means by which the American people can directly confront unlawful government conduct. Our right to petition, which embraces the government's obligation to respond, and our right to retain our money until our grievances are redressed, is essential to the protection and preservation of individual liberty and equal justice under the law. The American people are being systematically denied this unalienable right by the executive and legislative and judicial branches of the federal government. We, the people, have petitioned the executive and the legislative branches. They have unlawfully ignored our petitions. We are now retaining our money until the government answers our questions. Today, we begin the process of testing the attitude of the judiciary, where we seek a declaration of our rights and injunctive relief. I subscribe to LexisNexis, and in searching the Internet, searching our Supreme Court decisions and our law review articles and the like, some year ago or so, I came across 10 law review articles published since 1986. None before were published, and none have been published since. What happened in 1986 to trigger these law review articles, to awaken our law school professors, to cause them to do the research and to publish these articles in the law reviews? It turns out that President Reagan had nominated somebody to be a judge in the Supreme on one of the federal in one federal courts, and there was a citizen who objected, and that citizen wrote the president a letter and sent a copy of that letter to the House and Senate Judiciary Committees. In that letter, the citizen, in effect, said that this nominee was not qualified, and said a few other things about the man's background and his qualifications. The man did not get the appointment. He, however, sued the citizen who wrote the letter to the president, saying he was libeled. The citizen, with his attorney, in defense of the charges, brought up the First Amendment right to petition. And in his defense, he claimed that the right was absolute, that it was well settled in American jurisprudence that petitioners cannot be retaliated against. And the courts in that case, rightly so, said, no, that's not true. Your First Amendment rights are not absolute. For instance, you cannot yell fire in a crowded dark theater and claim right of free speech. And in this case, the court ruled that the First Amendment right to petition does not protect the defendant if he is libeling someone. That decision by the United States Supreme Court mentioning the right to petition sort of woke up the legal law school community. And they published these 10 articles. And I was thrilled to find them, read them, and they provided me and now hopefully you and others with the history, the original meaning, the history and the significance of the right to petition. You know, I talk to a lot of attorneys and I ask them, what does the First Amendment guarantee? And of course they're quick to recite it guarantees the right of free speech and freedom of religion and freedom of the press. They'll begin to slow down and they'll say in the right to peaceably assemble. Very few of them remember the right to petition. We learn from these papers, most significantly, the very thorough historical review of the right to petition by Dr. Gregory Mark from the Rutgers University School of Law and Justice in his paper, The Vestigial Constitution, the original meaning, the history and significance of the right to petition. We learn from these papers that the right to petition played a very significant role in the country before the Revolution and for many years afterwards. We learn that we have this fundamental right, and it is a capstone right. It's interesting to think of it in these ways. We know about many of our rights that we hear about in the press, through the press and in school. Our right, as I mentioned, of free worship and freedom of the press, right to trial by jury, right to no cruel and unusual punishment, right to property and privacy, and right to Second Amendment, to keep and bear arms, and so forth. But what happens if government infringes on any of those rights, and we don't have the right to petition and to expect government to respond to our petitions, and then the ability to enforce our rights nonviolently, hopefully? If we don't have the ability to petition for a redress of grievances and to enforce our rights, then we don't really have those rights. So we learn from what was common sense, but we learn from these law school professors that we have the right to petition any branch of government, and any issue is petitionable. It's an unalienable right to petition. The First Amendment to the United States Constitution states clearly and unambiguously, Congress shall make no law abridging the right of the people to petition the government for a redress of grievances. And it's interesting, while some rights are reserved with qualifications, in the Bill of Rights, there are none whatsoever, no qualifications pertaining to the right of redress. There are no limits on the right of redress. Any constitutional offense is legitimately petitionable. And again, any branch is petitionable. This right is the procedural mechanism that enables the people to call any branch of their servant government before them. The right to petition is the foundation of popular sovereignty and is the direct vehicle for the peaceful, nonviolent resolution of matters involving errant government. Petitioning the government for a redress of grievances naturally includes the ability to compel admissions, to ask questions, and to obtain answers. Jefferson wrote, "The right of freely examining public characters and measures and of free communication among the people thereon has ever been justly deemed the only effectual guardian of every other right." In America, the right to petition our government for a redress of grievances is the basis of our liberty. Our founders explicitly recognized this right in the very First Amendment to our Constitution, for they understood that without it, we could not have a servant government whose power is defined and limited by the consent of the people. The right to petition for redress is the essential cornerstone of popular sovereignty, a government of, by, and for the people. In 1791, the right to petition became primary among the rights of the people of the United States of America, as expressed and guaranteed in the First Amendment. Petitioning, we learn from Dr. Mark and others, petitioning was at the core of the constitutional law and politics of the early United States. That was why it was included in the First Amendment, not as an afterthought, but rather as its capstone. Petitioning embodied important norms of political participation in imperfectly representative political institutions. Petitioning was the most important form of political speech, according to Dr. Mark. For individuals and groups, it was a mechanism for redress of wrongs that transcended the stringencies of the courts and could force the government's attention on the claims of the governed when no other mechanism could. The Founding Fathers clearly declared that the right of redress of grievances includes the right to withhold payment of taxes while the grievances remain. By the First Amendment, the Founding Fathers secured for posterity the right of redress of grievances before payment of taxes, and they made the right of redress before taxes operate against the government, that is, against all branches of the government, the legislative, executive, and judicial branches. In other words, redress reaches all. We learn from history that the right to petition is an ancient, unalienable right. By the 17th century, monarchical challenge to a petition was defended on the basis that petitioning was an ancient right. Listen to the words of Supreme Court Justice Douglas in a decision he rendered, or in a decision he participated in Adderley versus Florida. The representatives of the people, this is Justice Douglas, referring to the ancient right of the right to petition. The representatives of the people vigorously exercised the right in order to gain the initiative in legislation and a voice in their government. By 1669, the House of Commons had resolved that it, quote, it is an inherent right of every commoner of England to prepare and present petitions to the House of Commons in case of grievance, and that no court whatsoever hath power to judge or censure any petition presented. The Bill of Rights of 1689 provided, quote, that it is the right of the subjects to petition the king, and all commitments and prosecutions for such petitioning are illegal. The right to petition for a redress of grievance was early asserted in the colonies, according to Justice Douglas. The Stamp Act, he wrote, the Stamp Act in Congress in 1765 declared that it is the right of the British subjects of these colonies to petition the king of either house or parliament. The declaration and resolves of the First Continental Congress, adopted in 1774, declared that the Americans have a right to peaceably assemble, consider their grievances, and petition the king, and that all prosecutions, prohibitory proclamations, and commitments for the same are illegal. And finally, Justice Douglas wrote, the Declaration of Independence assigned as one of the reasons for the break from England the fact that our repeated petitions have been answered only by repeated injury. The constitutions, Justice Douglas wrote, of many of the original states specifically guaranteed the right. The American Declaration of Independence, you may recall, lists the English king's injuries and usurpations, including among them his, the king's, undermining of the legitimate processes of colonial government. And only then, after it lists all of these grievances, does the Declaration of Independence say, in every stage of these oppressions, we have petitioned for redress in the most humble terms. Our repeated petitions have been answered only by repeated injury. A prince whose character is thus marked by every act which may define a tyrant is unfit to be the ruler of a free people, end quote, from your Declaration of Independence. That petitions were a legitimate vehicle by which to complain of the broadest spectrum of grievances is evident from the enumeration preceding the capstone complaint that the colonists' petitions fell on the king's deaf ears. The Declaration's litany runs the gamut from political usurpations to having plundered our seas, ravaged our coasts, burnt our towns, and destroyed the lives of our people. The public character of the grievances is immediately apparent, as is the colonists' felt view that petition was an appropriate remedy, indeed a remedy available in every stage of a grievance. The capstone of this list of grievances was the king's violence to the right to petition. The breaking apart of the bonds of deference and obligation on which hierarchical legitimacy rested. Having met the sole precondition for reception by petitioning in the most humble terms, the colonists felt entitled to consideration. That the king would not hear the colonists' petitions for redress was the ultimate violation and was wholly unacceptable. The answer sent by the king was repeated injury. Indeed, only by repeated injury. Clearly, more was expected, even required, even in contemporary politics of the day. The colonists held that tyranny marked a society in which the rulers ignored a free people. The meaning of petitions and the process of ception made it the capstone grievance in the Declaration and ultimately underlay the inclusion of the right to petition not as an afterthought, but as the capstone right in the First Amendment. Clearly, the right to petition protects proper petitions and petitioners. A communication to be protected as a petition for redress, we believe, would have to embody certain components to ensure that the document was a petition and not a pretended petition. Not all communications, nor just any document, can be regarded as a constitutionally protected petition for redress of grievances. Our petition for redress, our four petitions for redress of grievances, have met or exceeded any rational standard. If there ever was a standard for a proper petition for redress of grievances, we've met that standard. We've set that standard. Our petitions for redress regarding, again, the War Powers Clauses and its violation of the taxing clauses, violation of the money clauses, violation of the privacy clauses, our petitions for redress certainly do not rise to the level of frivolity. Our petitions contain no falsehoods. Our petitions are not absent probable cause. Our petitions have the quality of a dispute. Our petitions come from people outside of direct participation in the formal political culture of America. But the Constitution is part of our religion. Our petitions contain both a direction and a prayer for relief, the two fundamental requirements of any petition. Our petitions have been punctilious. Our petitions address public, collective grievances. Our petitions involve constitutional principles, not political talk. Our petitions have been signed. Our petitions have been dignified. Our petitions have widespread participation and consequences. Our petitions are instruments of deliberation, not agitation. And our petitions provide new information for the government to ameliorate the condition of the people. Our petitions do not advocate violence or crime. Our petitions merely request answers to simple questions. I could use a handkerchief for a napkin. Pardon me. Air conditioning does that to me. The remedy sought by plaintiffs, the remedy sought by our petitions for redress, has merely been the government's answers to certain questions related to the origin, the operation, the enforcement of a direct, unapportioned tax on the labor of America's working men and women, answers to certain questions regarding the Iraq resolution and the war powers clauses of the Constitution, answers to questions regarding the private cartel, the Federal Reserve System, and of course, answers to certain questions regarding the USA Patriot Act. The record shows that during the entire petition process, we have remained true to the Constitution, exercising not only our right to petition for a redress of grievances, but also our rights to freedom of speech, freedom of the press, and to peaceably assemble by joining with other people under the auspices of many organizations. The record shows that we have acted rationally, intelligently, and professionally at all times during the petition process, while always showing kindness and respect toward all appointed and elected representatives of our servant government. But on the other hand, the record shows that during the petition process, our servant government has failed to even acknowledge the receipt of these petitions, failed to even acknowledge their receipt of formal invitations to participate in academic symposiums and conferences. Our servant government has reneged on commitments, has broken promises, has held a congressional hearing on our newspaper ads without allowing us to testify at the hearing because, in the words of the committee chairman, our message, quote, will detract from the message they are trying to convey. Our government has failed to respond to private and open invitations to meet, to discuss the evidence and answer questions, has declared that notwithstanding the evidence to the contrary, the legality of the direct tax on labor does not have a high, is not a high priority matter for them. They have declared now twice publicly that rather than answer the people's questions about these grievances, it will deal harshly and swiftly with people who question, who retain their money, and question the validity of the direct tax. The government has now twice threatened and intimidated plaintiffs by the petitioners by declaring that the only way it will answer the people's questions is by litigation, by enforcement actions. Our servant government has shown little, if any, respect for the people and the rule book, the Constitution of the United States of America. The right to petition includes the right to be heard. Make no mistake, it includes the right to be heard. In colonial America, for decades, following the adoption of the Constitution and the Bill of Rights, the right of citizens to petition their local, state, and federal assemblies was an affirmative, remedial right which required governmental hearing and response. Because each petition commanded legislative consideration, citizens, in large part, controlled the legislative process. This original meaning and theory and practice of petitioning tripped when abolitionists flooded Congress with petitions during the debates over slavery. Southern congressmen acting on behalf of an entrenched, very special slavery interest were responsible for the adoption of a gag order in Congress. A gag order on further petitions, which in effect changed the construction of the Constitution without an Article 5 amendment. As a result, the right of petition was collapsed into the right of free speech and expression, an unconstitutional, definitional narrowing which went unchallenged in the courts until this day. In the colonies, petitions were almost always received and read and responded to. In practice, those ignored or rejected outright were very few in number. The right to petition carried a mandate of a hearing, but not of approval, of course. The original intent was a right which had compelled legislatures to accord citizens' petitions fair hearing and consideration. The founders' intent of the First Amendment Petition Clause included a governmental duty to consider petitioners' grievances. In its early years, Congress attempted to pass, favorably or unfavorably, on every petition it received. There was a day in America when you had a grievance, when you felt oppressed in any way at all, you felt government was operating without legal authority, and you submitted a petition to your congressman, your petition always went to a committee, was investigated, and you always received an answer in the early days of our country. Compare that with what is happening today. Frankly, unless you approach your congressman with a block of votes, a large block of votes that you can promise to deliver, or a large amount of money that you promise to contribute, you do not get a responsive response from your congressman. And, of course, we can prove that. Apathy, the lack of emotion and interest in public affairs, was not a prevailing attitude in America in the decades leading up to and following the adoption of the First Amendment and the right to petition, in large part because of the widespread practice of petitioning and the normal practice of having one's petition heard and responded to by the government. Assemblies responded to information from the people, even the disenfranchised, making petitions vital initiatives for governmental actions. Again, however, to repeat, the right to petition was not absolute. The fundamental right of petition was included in the Bill of Rights, even though, as Story wrote, quote, the right of petition would seem unnecessary to be expressly provided for in a Republican government, since it is impossible that it could be practically denied until the spirit of liberty had wholly disappeared and the people had become so servile and debased as to be unfit to exercise any of the privileges of free men. There can be no doubt that the petitioning of government was understood to be an inherent right, that the framers meant to imply a corresponding governmental duty of a fair hearing seems clear, given the history of petitioning in the colonies and the colonists' outrage at England's refusal to listen to their grievances. We also learn from history and from our friends at the law schools that the right to petition, while gagged, that John Quincy Adams led the fight for the repeal of that gag order, and he eventually succeeded 5 years later. But of course, by then, the precedent had been set, and the rest is history. It's gone downhill since. We've learned and have supporting evidence and argument from our friends at the law schools that the right to petition protects petitioners from retaliation. If communication to one's representatives could be arbitrarily ignored, refused, or punished, we've learned that popular sovereignty would then be threatened. Petitions were tied to distrust of and the imperfect nature of representative institutions and refusal to identify individuals' rights with or subordinate them to the wills of elected representatives, undue assertions of parliamentary privilege, punishing petitioners who were said to menace the dignity of the assembly, jeopardized the entire institution of petitioning. Punishing petitioners jeopardizes the First Amendment right to petition. Before a First Amendment right may be curtailed, we learn, under the guise of a law such as willful failure to file or promotion of an illegal tax shelter, any evil that may be collateral to the exercise of the right must be isolated and defined and in a narrowly drawn statute, according to the United States Supreme Court. Today's misdemeanors are being used to harass and penalize plaintiffs for exercising a constitutional right of assembly and petition. Tomorrow, a disorderly conduct statute, a breach of the peace statute, a vagrancy statute would be put to the same end. The government will undoubtedly say they are not targeting plaintiffs because of the constitutional principles they espouse. But however, that excuse is usually given, as we know from the many cases involving arrests of minority groups or breaches of the peace, unlawful assemblies, and parading without permits. The charge against William Penn, who preached a nonconformist doctrine in the streets of London, was that he caused a, quote, great concourse and tumult of people in contempt of the king and to the great disturbance of the peace. That was in 1670. Today, the government is moving to silence those of us who question government's behavior and preach a nonconformist doctrine. Our doctrine is that the government, they consider nonconformist, but our doctrine is that the government has an obligation to hear and answer the people's petitions for redress of grievances, and the people have a right to redress before taxes. Such abuse of police power is usually sought to be justified by some legitimate function of government. By attempting to suppress our orderly and civilized protest against the government's unconstitutional behavior and injustice, the government only increases the forces of frustration, which the conditions of second-class citizenship are generating among us. The government does violence to the First Amendment when it attempts to turn a petition for redress of grievances into a tax shelter or a willful failure to file action. Shortly, we will be filing our complaint in district court, asking the court to direct the two political branches to answer our questions. Not an easy thing for the judiciary to direct other branches to carry out their constitutional obligations. They don't do it lightly. We're asking the court to enjoin the two political branches, and especially the executive branch, from taking any further enforcement action against any petitioners who are retaining their money until their grievances are redressed.